Cheering at pro wrestling shows in Japan is back, and 2023 is already shaping up to be a big year in the history of pro res. That's why you should listen to the Emerald Flow Show. From the Royal Road to the Green Mat, Paul and Gerard take you into the world of All Japan Pro Wrestling and Pro Wrestling NOAH. Not only do we analyze events, but we examine business, who is getting over, what angles are working or not. Occasionally, we take a look at other Japanese promotions like DDT and Zero One. So if you're looking for more coverage of the world of Japanese wrestling, check out the Emerald Flow Show on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on all of your favorite podcast apps.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back to an episode of The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. I'm your host, Tyler Fornes. With me, as always, is my co-host, Fred Moreland, who is on a sabbatical. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I am back from my sabbatical, but don't worry, the show is not canceled. It just ended. It started at the start of the show, and I'm back now. I'm doing well. It's just been kind of a quiet week. AW, I don't think, has had too much big stuff going on. Wrestling in general, I think, has had been a little bit of a quieter week, I feel like. You know, some good matches and stuff. But just as far as big news, I think it's just kind of, you know, in between there. And, yeah. So my instinct when we start slow is to start by asking you, because every week something comes out. So EA Sports College Football 25, Tyler.
Yes.
How excited are you? Anything new that you've seen this week about the video game?
Well, they're actually going to put the second deck on the Texas State Stadium, which is great because I'm going to lead the Bobcats to a few natties. I'm really excited about that.
The Bobcats?
Of Texas State, yeah.
Oh, Texas State. I thought you said Texas Tech, and I was like,
Nah, Texas Tech, it's... They're too good of a program. You got to run a G5 school. And I love what GJ Kinney has done there. He's only been there 1 year, but he made Texas State relevant. Like, really good. A little inconsistent, but that can happen when you have like 60 transfer portal players your first year and they're establishing a recruiting base. But he runs like a more traditional air raid, but he does that with a very diverse running game focused on like counter. Mm-hmm. And oh, it's great. It feels like real football with fake football mixed in, because everybody runs fake football offenses nowadays. Yeah. Like it's they just kind of became my team. I remember I'm like, oh, Texas State, I want to see where GJ Kinney's doing, because he was the head coach at Incarnate Word. And that 2022 season, they had back to back games in the FCS playoffs. They beat Sacramento State, I think it was 74-68 in the quarterfinals. Sac State was the number one seed. Then they go to Fargo and lose to the Bison, I think it was 38-35 in the semifinals. Like, that Incarnate Word team was really good. I'm going to tell my kids about the legend of Lindsey Scott. He was so much fun in that playoff run. But he goes to Texas State. I'm like, oh, I'll tune in. And then they're up like 21-0 on Baylor week one. I'm like, what? And I just rolled the wave. That was a fun as hell season to watch. A little frustrating because TJ Finley, very inconsistent quarterback. When he was on, he was lights out. They bring in Jordan McLeod from James Madison. I'm really kind of excited to see how that offense looks in year two. They have some really interesting receivers, so we'll kind of find out. But yeah, I'm so excited for this game. I told my wife, leave me alone for a couple days. She's like, why? I'm like, NCAA. She's like, really? I'm like, we haven't gotten a new NCAA game in 11 years. I'm leading Texas State to a natty.
I don't know if you listened to this week's full cast yet, but they had Matt Brown on, and in true full cast form, they're like, we're going to talk about the video game. And then they talked about different video games for the majority of the episode. But they started with going over some questions that Matt Brown gets from people, because he's kind of become like the foremost reporter on, or one of the foremost, I should say, on the game. And people are just asking him like in-scene questions and also demanding that he answers them for free. And so it's just very, very funny how insane people are. But that's worth checking out if you haven't yet. Let's see. In my realm of sports, we had the absolute worst discourse this side of Wrestling Talk. Which was the Caitlin Clark gets fouled discourse.
Oh, God.
Good Lord. We talk about how bad and dumb, you know, the wrestling media is. But this was a big old fumble. I wanted to stick my head under like a train track, you know, just good Lord. Just the absolute dumbest takes on like a relatively minor issue. But, you know, we're all paying attention to, you know, the WNBA now, I guess. So because Caitlin Clark and, you know, so now we get just the absolutely stupidest discourse, except for, oh, God, I'm going to blank on her name. McNutt.
Monica.
Monica McNutt. Yes. Just like killed Stephen A. Smith on his own show.
Legendary. Now,
should just get his show now. I think that's how it works.
Did you see that on his podcast after that? Stephen A. Smith went defended himself for like 36 minutes.
Yeah, I'm not reading all that, but you know, good for you, or I'm sorry.
Here's my problem.
100%, I'm not mad.
Yeah, my issue is that people are covering women's basketball that don't really understand what's going on in the sport, and people have been really adamant about women's basketball getting more coverage because it is a quality product. And especially in the WNBA, there's so few teams that like first round picks from the prior year can get cut, even though they're good players, just because year. Yeah. Like there's too many players and not enough teams. And one of the issues is the league just doesn't draw enough revenue to have serious expansion right now. Like, It's an economical problem, not a talent problem. Oh,
five years ago, the finances did not work. The finances work now, and it's not just because of Caitlin Clark. You're going to hear some people say that Caitlin Clark has helped a lot and made it better, but they were on the path to like the whole charter flight expansion thing last year, before she was even part of the equation. So for the past year or two, WNBA revenues have been up enough to, well, and pretty well, that, you know, they actually had people express interest in expansion teams, and that's why there's going to be one in Toronto in 2 years and one in Oakland / San Francisco in a year.
Yeah, it's good that the sport's getting more coverage. Unfortunately, it's getting the wrong kind of coverage from people who are missing the point or just bad. And yeah. I'll leave it at that. And part of the problem is people have been begging for more coverage for a long time. Well, it's unfortunate
because we're not getting good coverage.
I almost want coverage to be gatekeeped because of how bad some of this coverage is. People just not understand. Look, I 100%. Don't understand. I don't understand the dynamics of women's basketball, Fred. You understand the women's the dynamics of women's basketball and it's how like the WNBA
I'm not like
flows.
An expert. Yeah.
Yeah, but get it. It's different from the NBA. There are different elements at play, and to hear people talk about it when it sounds like they're completely talking out of their ass is just really disheartening for the product as a whole. And if you truly want to grow this product and you truly want to be an asset in helping that, at least know what the hell you're talking about. But unfortunately, in today's media, that's too much to ask for in general. It just looks even worse in a situation like this. Look, Kennedy Carter just bombed Caitlin Clark. Yeah. But you know what nobody talks about? Caitlin Clark trash talking her ass nonstop. Look, it's not like she didn't earn it. Like, it's basketball. You talk that much shit and you get in someone's head, they're going to get you. And how she got gotten? No, it should have been a flagrant. But it's not like Caitlin Clark is this innocent little girl. No, she's such a big trap. She's such a big shit talker. Her dad told her on national television with the camera on him to shut the fuck up.
Yes.
Like,
Caitlin trash talked in her career. She you know, in her college career, she's doing it in the W.
She's going to become an all-time shit talker. And like, I don't think that's hyperbole here. She is going to be an all-time shit talker. She's going to get bombed. Like, the great ones get bombed. If you stink or you get into their head enough, guess what? You better watch for that elbow. You better watch for that hip check, because it's coming. And you know what?
Well,
good
also
on Caitlin Clark for flopping, man. Good on Caitlin Clark, because if you're going to get hit like that, you sell the hell out of that.
Yeah, I hesitate to call it a flop just because it was a legit hit, you know, and I could believe that she was off balance, but I also totally believe she sold it, and that's different to me than flopping. If you get fouled and you sell it some, but you were actually fouled, that's a completely different thing than a flop. That's not a flop.
That's a great distinction.
That's pedantic, but it's, I think it is an important distinction, because, you know, the conversation about flopping over the past 15 years or whatever in basketball has really been insane. Also, we just can't talk about things in a reasonable way. But I just feel like it's really important to differentiate between these two things. Caitlin Clark, she's going to get hit, because half of her game is driving into the paint, and the WNBA is historically, and until the last few years, that was very much a big dominated league. And they are slowly, you know, there's been exceptions, obviously. It's not like there hasn't been Super Diana Taurasi, et cetera, not to mention other great players from the past. But, you know, it's been very much built around big post play. And Caitlin is going to be charged with driving into the lane a lot, and she's going to get fouled hard. Hopefully every time it happens, we don't end up with this, panic discourse about how the only reason the WNBA matters at all is Caitlin Clark. It's not. What they should actually do is just let her go to the basket and score and not defend or anything crazy like that. But it's very frustrating and insane conversations, and it is it's nutty. It's just really nutty. But you know, it's fascinating to watch in that train wreck kind of way. Now, did you see where security had to keep some dude away from Kennedy Carter as she got off the bus in DC?
It wasn't just Carter. They had to escort a guy out of the building for trying to get too close to Angel Reese. I think that's what it was. She was on the court, but like, can men just be normal with women, please?
We cannot have normal conversations about women athletes in general. Whether it was Simone Biles, having her personal mental health issues, I think it was, and needing to step away from gymnastics for a while, and then like just crazy people screaming about how dare she be soft, which is an insane take and really just an asshole take, or the Caitlin Clark foul. Like a week ago, Angel Reese basically got almost shoot choke slammed by Alyssa Thomas, who was second in MVP voting last year. And there was no panic about that because, Angel Reese isn't Caitlin Clark. Fouls happen in basketball. Dirty plays happen in basketball. Kennedy Carter foul was a dirty play. It was a bullshit play, but it wasn't like close to causing an injury or anything. And I think that the panic around it is just absolutely nuts. But it's very frustrating. It's very disappointing. And, I would say that hopefully things will get better, but unless you're like digging deep into the hardcore, podcast, way deep, if you're getting past like surface level coverage from goofs that really don't know much about the NBA or WNBA, then you're going to have a hard time with that, unfortunately. And, It's fun. Yay.
All right, let's move to another thing of fun, Fred, because I think we could talk about this kind of stuff all day. But look, we are not the flagship. We are an AEW podcast, so we should probably focus on that a little bit. But you have something fun that you gathered.
Yeah.
Because there's been a lot of discussion at the beginning of June, because the beginning of June has some of the best matches in pro wrestling history.
Yeah. So I think one thing I'm thinking about doing on a weekly basis until I forget, so probably next week, is the day that we record, which today is June 7th, is to go through Cage Match and come up with a list of, at least according to their voters, of the best matches that have ever happened on that day in history. Now, there's going to be obviously a big asterisk that there's a possibility that there are matches that are missed by the voters, blah, blah, blah. That's all really boring. The important thing is basically let's remember some dudes. So I did that for today, and I have gone back and pulled the top 10 matches from wrestling history that took place on June 7th, according to Cage Match. And I'm going to run through them real quick. I have seen probably only three of these. I really should. I'll have to next week try to get out in front of this and, you know, actually watch all these. But here we are. All right. So quick honorable mention to a trio of WWE matches. There are no WWE matches in the top 10. With an asterisk to that comment, we'll see in a second. Apparently last year, or 2020, which feels like last year, was now 4 years ago because time is a flat circle, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Was Edge versus Randy Orton in WWE that got an 8.36 with 304 votes.
Fuck that. That's the Benoit choke spot match. That's from WrestleMania, yeah, isn't it?
I'm double checking here.
Oh, no, that would have been the second one. Never mind. WrestleMania wasn't in June. I think
that was, yeah, not in June, no. Yeah, I think this would have been the second one. But yeah, that got highly voted. Hey, look, this is what happens, you know, especially with modern.
Yeah, because the WrestleMania match, they fought all through the Performance Center, and mm-hmm. they did the weightlifting choking spot that people related to the Benoit stuff. And
yeah, this was the pre-taped main event for Backlash 2020, which was taped on the 7th and then aired on the 14th as part of that show, which they were doing because obviously the pandemic was a weird time. And actually, this was the first match, our last match for Edge for about 6 months because he got injured during the taping of it because they decided to retape a move. I forget what it was now. It's been a while. 44 minutes, 45 seconds was this match. I don't know that I'm going to be going back to watch that one. Oof, that's a big ask. That one, I think is 13th all time. 12 and 11 are from the same show in 2009 for WWE, which had a no holds barred match between Chris Jericho and Rey Mysterio. This was Extreme Rules, and then Edge and Jeff Hardy in a ladder match. So those two just finished outside the top 10. But like I said, no WWE matches in the top 10, technically, because number 10 is Dean Ambrose and William Regal in FCW from 2012.
Hell yeah, I love that.
2009 is from a Ring of Honor show in 2008. I should have grabbed the show names, but I wasn't that smart, so apologies. Maybe next time. This was in 2008, a Ring of Honor show, which will pop up again. This was Austin Aries and Bryan Danielson in a tag match against Jimmy Jacobs and Tyler Black. Meltzer gave that 4.25 stars. This got this is currently sitting at 8.69 with 34 votes. Next up is American Dragon versus Low-Key in a tap out match for Jersey All Pro Wrestling in 2002. So when they were little babies, leading the indie scene back then, that's at 8.73 with 36 votes. Next up, number 7 is Eric Stevens against Roderick Strong in a Fight Without Honor from that same Ring of Honor show in 2008. That also got 4.25 stars from Meltzer, sitting at 8.78 with 36 votes. Number 6 is from New Japan. in June 7th, which I guess, or this was in 2021, and I don't know if that was a best of Super Junior final or not. No, this is a Osaka Joe Hall show, I guess, according to Cage Match. So this was for the vacant IWGP World Heavyweight Championship, with Shingo Takagi beating Kazuchika Okada. Number five, beating that out, is from DDT in 2020, Masato Tanaka against Tetsuya Endo at 9.03. Number four in 2016 is a best of the Super Junior final with Ryusuke Taguchi against Will Ospreay, which Dave Meltzer gave 4.25 stars. Number three is from 1996 in All Japan Pro Wrestling, with Johnny Ace and Steve Williams against Jun Akiyama and Mitsuharu Misawa, which sounds absolutely amazing. Dave gave that 5. It's at 9.12. Number two is from CMLL in 2011. And if it's a cage match with a high rating for a CMLL match, you know, it's you know, it must see. It's a Gero Maya Jr. against Virus for, I think, the vacant welterweight championship, if I recall correctly. And number one, the CMLL one was at 9.23, but number one in 2015 is 9.53 with 229 votes and a Dave Meltzer rating of 4.75, is the 2015 Best of Super Junior final of Kushida against Kyle O'Reilly, which ripped.
Oh, that match was great, dude. That match was so good.
Remembering some dudes and some matches, for sure.
Yes.
Which I did, because it's kind of a quiet week in AEW. We got ourselves a couple of notes, and then we had obviously Dynamite to talk about briefly. I didn't think it was a terribly noteworthy or great show. But the biggest story, I think, in this week is that the Forbidden Door is open just a little more, Tyler. Now, I think this is getting maybe slightly blown out of proportion in terms of how big of a deal it is, but at the same time, it is notable. It's a big deal, but not a huge deal, is what I'm trying to say. Basically, CMLL has reached the point where they are willing to have Mexican talents that are not theirs, but are also not with AAA, work on the same shows as their own talents. And that's noteworthy because they were notorious for holding grudges, basically, against people that left them and went to AAA, even after they no longer were with AAA. And so there are stories last year for Forbidden Door about how guys like Roosh or Pentagon Jr. Or Ray Phoenix, who all had, I think at that time, left AAA, if I'm not mistaken, maybe Penta was still with them. He might have been the one guy. I know Ray left earlier than Penta. But basically, now they can book those guys on the same show as CMLL guys, where before they could not. This is not a huge deal, because the only people that I think are really actually modern day AAA talents are that work with AEW, I should specify, are Commander and the injured Hijo del Vikingo. So it's not like that they're, there's a lot of people that are still going to be banned from work on the same show as those CML guys. But being able to have a little freedom where they can book, say, MJF and Roosh on Forbidden Door, and use Penta on Forbidden Door if they want to, and Ray Phoenix. That's a nice touch. That's nice to be able to have that. It's nice that the relationship between AEW and CML has worked out that well. And that's good news, for just ease of booking and access to high level talents.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
And that's a feather in Tony Khan's cap, too, to be able to work that well with CMLL, where they're willing to do this.
No, this isn't a feather in Tony Khan's cap at all. This is 100% a feather in Rocky Romero's. This is Rocky Romero bridging the gap and making it happen. And AEW doesn't have any real partnership with AAA anymore. So I think this is great. I think I think CMLL involvement in Forbidden Door rules. I wish we would have gotten it earlier. And
it's cool that we got it.
Yeah. Dude, give me Mystico versus Bryan Danielson.
Yes, please,
I need it. Bryan can lose to Mystico. It doesn't matter.
Like, I mean, Ryan's losing everyone pretty much except for Jeff Jarrett. So,
wee woo, wee woo. Look, this is gonna be fun. I'm really excited to see how this Forbidden Door shapes up and looks when it's all said and done and ready to go. I think some of the New Japan stuff is a little overblown as far as like, oh, like the AEW title's main eventing. The AEW title's main evented every single Forbidden Door except for the last one, which was, I mean, the main event to the first one, and then you had Danielson Okada for the second one.
Like, yeah.
I think, you know, who cares? Like, it's a co-branded show, but let's not act like New Japan hasn't been treated well throughout the process of booking Forbidden Door, because they have been.
Yeah, I, you know, I see where people are coming from. I do think that maybe just outright doing an AEW versus AEW main event for Forbidden Door is not ideal. I don't think it's a disaster, to be clear, but it's probably
at least it's Will Ospreay, where Ospreay was a New Japan wrestler for almost 10 years.
But he's not, you know, yeah, but he's not now, you know. So
I get that, but there was the first Forbidden Door had, I'm going to call it 1.5 New Japan talents, because Moxley is, I guess you could call him a New Japan regular. I mean, the pandemic kind of shifted things heavily, but he was a New Japan regular before the pandemic hit. And they still use him heavily on all these U.S. shows. So I call him a New Japan regular. We'll go 1.5. Last year, 1 out of 2. This year, I'd go 0.5 out of 2, because Ospreay is so New Japan adjacent, even though he's a fully contracted AEW wrestler now. Like, I is it ideal for Forbidden Door show to have that? Not really. But let's see how the rest of the card shapes up, because the rest of the card, and like, it's starting to shape up pretty nicely.
Yeah, I think it'll be a great card. I
also point this out, Fred. Who is challenging for that AEW world title to make it like a legit match? Like, last year's title matches were a sham. Like, Hiroshi Tanahashi, who we all love, he's just washed. Everybody knew he was losing to MJF. Everybody knew Jungle Boy was losing to Sonata. Those title matches didn't mean anything. This is the first time a title match really feels like it means something on this show. Like, we knew that Moxie was going to beat Tanahashi, even though it felt like, oh, maybe Tanahashi can pull out the win. Nah. This is the first time at a Forbidden Door show a title feels like it could really be on the line.
Yeah. It is a complicated situation. I can't really say anyone's wrong for feeling positively or negatively about the status of New Japan in that main event. I think that's pretty reasonable if you're a New Japan diehard to, be put off by it or let down by it. At the same time, I think it's just about, you know, the biggest match they could reasonably make for this show, with the exception of maybe MJF's Swerve, but I feel like that's rushing it a little bit. But, you know, I also think part of the problem is that New Japan, you know, Tanahashi is in a deep decline. They no longer have Okada and Ospreay because they're both in AEW full time. Now, I think that there's some people that would be pointed that and say that's AEW's fault, you know, and I think it's a little more complicated than just being mad at Tony Khan for signing these guys when they're free agents. I don't know. It's a really complicated situation. I would probably prefer to see, you know, someone from New Japan challenge Swerve rather than just, you know, going with internal AEW stuff and then, you know, punt the Swerve Ospreay match down the line a little bit. Now, I also assume that what they're going to do is they're going to have Swerve beat Ospreay so he gets a nice feather in his cap, and then do the rematch at All In so that Ospreay can get that win back. Possibly after fighting off a betrayal by the Don Callis family. But I just think that they want to help legitimize Swerve as a main eventer. And I think that that's what they're doing here. and it's going to do a better job than, you know, whoever they could have got for 2023 or for that main event from New Japan. Because looking back at 2023 and I think 2022 as well, Naito did not make the trip and doesn't really make the trip to America very often. And so at that point, you're getting down to, you know, like the next generation guys of Tsuji, Umino, et cetera, and so the question is kind of, well, are they really going to be needle movers in the U.S.? You know, is Shingo Takagi really going to draw buys in the U.S.? And I think Tony Khan made a fair business decision, and yeah, but I do think that it would have been nice if Forbidden Door could have kept the gimmick of AEW versus New Japan as the main event.
Yeah, I just really don't think it's that big of a deal, but I suppose that's going to be in the eye of the beholder. But we'll kind of find out how a lot of this show shapes up, because it's going to be very interesting to see a lot of the rest of this is booked. Speaking of bookings, Fred, I think we need to talk about this Arlington residency. Brandon sure. Thurston of WrestleNomics got documents showing that AEW is getting a 50% discount on the booking fee for the shows, which is a considerable amount of money. It looks like every show that they're airing is $14,000, which mm-hmm. booking a 2,500 seat venue, $14,000 feels relatively cheap considering all the other outside extraneous factors like merch sales and concessions and all that. Like, I'm really intrigued to see how well this works. It feels like a smaller scale of what WWE is trying to do by co-opting towns for WrestleMania and SummerSlam. And if it works, I think it's great. We'll find out if it works, and we'll find out what that looks like. So I'm very, very intrigued. I think this could be really awesome. I also think it'll be cool to see wrestling in a unique setting like this again.
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see how ticket sales go. They dodged a bullet because the Mike Tyson Paul match got pushed back. So they kind of don't have to, you know, and the importance of that is that it was happening like literally across the street at Jerry World.
The one interesting thing that I found about that is I wondered how many people might try to double dip, because you go to Collision from 7 to 9 and then the main card starts at 9. And you'd miss half of the first fight, but you wouldn't miss any of Paul and Tyson.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how much crossover there would be with it across the street. We'll never know now, but I found that part very interesting.
Yeah, that would have been interesting to see. You could make an argument that maybe it would have been positive, but I frankly had my doubts. I just didn't really see that working out. But yeah, I mean, it's probably to their benefit that got moved, and so they kind of don't have to worry about the drama of that. Now, there's also reporting, or Thurston reported that in the documents that he got, it seems like AEW is going to get a little money from the local tourism group for Arlington to help entice them to go there. Yeah, I think that... it's, you know, it's interesting to get those details. One thing Meltzer wrote in the Observer this week, which I thought was interesting, I want to bring up, is AEW has been running a lot of smaller towns recently, and so he thinks that's their way of saving money, because those buildings are obviously going to cost less. Now, you know, the inverse is that they're going to probably get fewer people there. But if you just go through and ignore like the show, you know, the Double or Nothing Las Vegas one. They have recently held shows at Loveland, Colorado, Palm Desert, California, Inglewood, California, Bakersfield, California. They did hit Portland, Everett, Washington, Vancouver, you know, Edmonton and Winnipeg. Those are all major Canadian cities. And then Daly's Place. So you have to go back to Modynasty. You know, that's a pay-per-view, obviously. So that's St. Louis. So before that, it was Peoria, Indianapolis, Highland Heights, Kentucky, a.k.a. Fake Cincinnati, Charleston, West Virginia, Worcester, Mass., and then back into Canada. So I think, that's interesting. And if you look at the forthcoming schedule, you know, like Collision this Saturday is in Council Bluffs, Iowa. The... Mm-hmm. How is that the, I gotta look something up real quick. It is the 10th most populous city in Iowa.
Now, I think Council Bluffs is, it's the suburb of the Des Moines area. So like it would be similar to All Out being in Hoffman Estates.
What's going on, guys? This is Rich, co-host of the Flagship Podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcast Network. We'll get right back to your show. Just want a brief moment to tell you about a sponsor that we have here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcast Network, Arena Club. Now, Arena Club, man, they're great for card collectors. If you're a card collector out there, this is the read for you. And in this hobby, I know you know, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up. We think, oh man, here's the 86 Michael Jordan Fleer rookie card. It's going to be in this pack. It never is. It's never in that pack. And usually you don't have zero. You have zero transparency on available cards and hit rates. It's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing slab packs from ArenaClub.com. The only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each and every one. And when I buy slab packs from Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. And I've talked about before, I go to card shows, I grab random packs, I have fun opening them, but I know there's nothing good ever in there. There never is. There's never going to. Why? That's why they're available to buy, because there's nothing good in there. That's not the case anymore with Arena Club slab packs. They're better than those mystery packs because they have a display of available cards. They have a display of the hit rates. They have a display of the grading. You know exactly what you're getting. It's transparent. And Arena Club, more than that, they're an awesome place for collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying. If you're a card collector, you get it all at Arena Club. Now, Arena Club slab packs are revolutionizing the repack game, like we said, with full transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed into your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. And the Arena Club grading process is great. It's fast, it's accurate, it's transparent, with a full grade rationale provided, an explanation of how your card was scored. You're not putting this thing in an envelope, send it out to the mail, and then get back a number. Oh, it's a 6.2. Why? Whatever. Too bad. We just said it was 6.2. No, you get all of the rationale, all the explanation of how your card is scored and how it is graded. And man, Arena Club, whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. But there's even better news here, because right now you can get 10% off your first purchase at Arena Club by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Make sure you use that link to get the 10% off your first purchase. Again, arenaclub.com/VOWnet. That is a crazy offer. That is 10% off of your first purchase of anything. If it's a $400 slab pack, you're getting $40 off immediately just by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Anyways, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase. arenaclub.com/VOWnet, 10% off your first purchase. And we appreciate them for sponsoring the Voice Wrestling Podcast Network. Now, back to your show.
Yeah, Omaha, not Des Moines, because they're going to Des Moines next Wednesday. But, you know, these aren't exactly big, big cities, right? Des Moines, Youngstown, Ohio, Fairfax, Virginia, which is outside D.C., Allentown, Pennsylvania, all those bad streets, Buffalo, New York, Elmont, New York for Forbidden Door. And then we go back to Chicago on July 3rd. I just think it's, you know, interesting to look at. You know, it's not like they're doing major cities for Dynamite currently, you know, and or Collision. So that's, I don't know what that means, really. I mean, they're probably trying to cut down costs, but, you know, ticket sales are a problem for AEW currently. They continue to be live ticket sales, not for the pay-per-views, but for just run-of-the-mill Dynamites and Collisions. And, you know, in the mainstream media, there's been some discussion over the past few weeks, or past week, I should say, about the possibility of a bubble popping with ticket prices, because I believe last year we had a big discussion about how AEW is very much changing their ticket strategy to try to just keep costs up on tickets and maximize the money they're bringing in. Well, recently, several high-profile tours by musicians such as the Black Keys that were going to be in arenas, and it's kind of odd to think of the Black Keys in 2024 as an arena act, but, you know, they had to cancel those tours just because of a lack of ticket sales. So I do wonder if that's something we'll end up seeing in wrestling, if AEW will have to modify their strategy. hard to say at this point. I really don't know, but it's just something to, you know, just a thought I had, something to keep an eye on, so on and so forth. So
I think it's going to be very interesting to kind of keep an eye on the ticket strategy, especially because if you recall, Fred, just a few months ago, they did change their live booking coordinator. I think that was the title. So they had shows booked all the way through March at that point. So now we're starting to kind of see what the differences are. And I think being in, like, last night or Wednesday night, I mean, they were in Loveland, Colorado, which I think is a suburb of Denver. And sometimes if you go to a suburb, that doesn't matter to the people in the town. Like, Bloomington is where the old Metropolitan Stadium was. And if you know that with Metropolitan Stadium, that's where they built Mall of America. It's super close to the airport, and it's a hop, skip, and a jump from downtown, around 15 minutes to downtown Minneapolis. You just shoot right up I-35. And that's really not that big of a deal. The Minnesotans, Bloomington, Minneapolis, that's fine. Doesn't matter. But you hear Bloomington, if you're not from the area and you don't understand the demographics and the geography, you're like, oh, they're running this rinky-dink town. No, Bloomington's got a population of like 100,000. It's right outside Minneapolis. Like, that's where the airport is. And I think some of those optics will matter as far as public perception, but they don't matter in terms of booking. They don't matter in terms of drawing attendance. I don't think there's going to be a discernible difference between booking what used to be called the Pepsi Center, where the Nuggets and Avalanche play, versus the arena that they booked in Loveland, which I think might be a minor league hockey or G League basketball arena. There's no discernible difference to the people of the area, because you're still going to see a big show. You're just going to see it in a suburb and not like the actual downtown proper. So I really don't see a huge deal with it, but public perception wise, I completely get it.
Yeah. And going back to the ticket pricing issue, you know, I personally, my frame of mind would be with AEW in 2024, their big source of income is going to be TV money. So I would prioritize bigger houses versus more money per head. But, you know, they're obviously going in a different direction and have been, you know, just kind of, I don't know. That's just my dumb opinion. I don't know how much that matters, but not very much, frankly. So I didn't know what else to put this under other than anti-AEW reporting, because there were two things that happened this past week that were very... You know, we started with the WNBA talk earlier, and we just have very dumb discussions about things. So two things happened. One, the story came out on June 2nd that Collision's Fast Nationals, they got somehow magically got to certain members of the wrestling media, air quotes. And, you know, if I would be shocked, astonished, taken aback if the source of this was not WWE PR, but that the Fast Nationals for Collision were 122,000 viewers with 34,000 the key demo, which sounds like apocalyptic numbers, just completely awful. But the that's not what they were at all. You know, when the actual numbers came out, they were just like normal, you know, high 300s or whatever it is for Collision. I should have pulled up that number, but I didn't because I'm not very smart. But yeah, like, and so the thought is that what happened is the Fast Nationals number for the planned time slot, if Collision was actually moved for NBA playoffs, which would have been midnight to 2 a.m., was put out there as the Fast National rating. Of course, there was no NBA playoff game last Saturday, so the show was not moved from its normal time. But that did get the normal AEW is imminently dying RIP to a dumb company that these companies hate or these people hate. An astonishing thing that anyone would like give that number and not give it a second thought and would just put it out there. You know, obviously there's going to be some people with their own agenda, but we're just like, at this point, it's just a step away from just like outright making up facts, you know, air quotes facts on that. Just outright saying stuff in the dumbest possible way. And the second thing is that Fightful reported that Will Ospreay had this week off, you know. Every, you know, like Fightful, Meltzer, etc., they, you know, everyone puts these little news nuggets on their things, you know, whether it be Dave's newsletter to add in a few, you know, a paragraph or whatever. It's just a normal, you know, no Will Ospreay this week. Okay. Well, then Ringside News.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. They ran a headline that Will Ospreay was taking a sabbatical. And of course, because no one actually reads, you know, reads a actual article, and their article did contain, although, you know, oddly phrased, I would say, it did say that he was taking the week off in the actual body of the story. But you have to get to the third paragraph, although in the first, you know, for it to actually say that he's been given the week off and that he's coming back next week. But, you know, the usage of the word sabbatical is wildly inaccurate. Just not good at all. And of course, you know, a bunch of people that will use news from Ringside as, you know, air quotes news. Yeah, just completely insane, man. This became a big story. You had, of all people, Aldo Montoya burying the work ethic of Will Ospreay on Twitter, saying that he worked 30 matches in 30 days in Germany, which Aldo Montoya never did, and talked about how obviously Will Ospreay just needs to get over himself.
Wait, wasn't that just incredible that said well, that?
Yeah, Aldo Montoya.
Oh, same guy. Okay.
I just will always think of him as Aldo Montoya because that was my first introduction to him with his goofy little yellow mask. The Portuguese Man of War. You know, we just lived in a cursed time. So it's great. Just fantastic. Love it. I don't know, man. Like, you know, we talked about this a little bit ago about how AEW is desperately losing the PR war. It's not getting better. It's not getting better because you've got these, you know, Ringside News has tremendous reach despite not doing a good job at anything. And, yeah, if I'm not mistaken, r/squared circle has banned Ringside News from being posted on their subreddit for, you know, just not being, reliable. And, you know, that's a hell of a thing to say. That's all. I'll leave it at that. All right. Other news, a couple quick notes. Chuck Taylor was on Up Close with Renee Paquette, on YouTube, which is worth a watch. It's a nice little 20-minute sit-down interview. Chuck Taylor is a delight, as always. They do eventually get around to his ankle, and it's actually a pretty major point in their conversation, but he talks about how he doesn't consider himself retired. He is currently actually learning how to do production stuff backstage for AEW. So his plan, he said, is to just do that through the summer because he doesn't want to interrupt that. He feels like he's just kind of gotten started with that, and he feels like he has more to learn, and he doesn't want to get halfway through it and then, you know, go away for surgery. So he's going to keep doing that backstage stuff with AEW through the summer, but he does hope to eventually return to the ring. So it sounds like he's going to get surgery on his ankle in an attempt to accomplish that, but he's just not doing it right away. There is a report that Penta's contract will be up in August or September. There was another, I think Meltzer noted that WWE was interested. Hard to say if they'll put him with the Uncle Howdy group or feud him against other Latin Americans. Or people of Latino heritage, I guess we should say instead. Yeah, it's just it's interesting to see what will happen there. I think the same thing, according to Cubs fan, it said that Penta is very happy with AEW. I'd be pretty surprised if he ended up somewhere else. I do wonder if he's going to be more available for other dates in Japan with New Japan, given the news with, you know, that change in policy for CMLL. You know, mm-hmm. Maybe that will carry over to New Japan. Maybe it won't. We'll see. But hopefully, you know, I think Penta's output will be best outside of WWE. I think that's pretty, you know, much the case for anyone that can wrestle well. Frankly, I hate to say that, but, you know, just that's just a personal view. And the last news item I have is that Bulk Bronson, a.k.a. Bear Bronson, came out as bisexual at the start of Pride Month this month. Congratulations to him for feeling comfortable enough to do that. And we wish him nothing but the best, obviously.
Absolutely. I'm going to call it now Penta in the G1.
That would be pretty cool. You know, one thing we have, or at least I've talked about before, is I do think AEW has been underwhelming in terms of who they send over for these, tournaments in New Japan, that they could definitely afford to send some guys over for of a bigger name. And, you know, obviously they're not going to send over like MJF in the middle of a major storyline or anything like mm-hmm. that. Forge. But, you know, like Rey Fénix or Penta would obviously be a good pick to send over there. Especially if they don't have anything currently planned for them. And I actually think it would be beneficial to AEW to do that, to send over bigger guys, for these tournaments to get them, you know, maybe a little extra exposure in Japan, but just to kind of vary it up, because, you know, we always talk about how AEW likes to position itself, as at the center of the wrestling world. So everything that happens in wrestling matters there, you know, so you send your guy over to, do the G1, and he finishes, you know, 6-3 or whatever, you know, and you can talk about that when he comes back. So,
yeah, and that's I just think it's interesting to have a guy like Penta, because there'd be so many fresh matchups, and one of the mm-hmm. tough parts about like some Western fans really staying invested in the promotion is there just isn't a lot of star power right now. There's a lot of future and potential star power, but one of the reasons why John Moxley has the belt is because they're really isn't a lot of star power. And the whole idea of having Moxley have it, well, one, he's a New Japan regular, so it's not like you're giving a true outsider the belt, but you have to like build up some of these stars. And I think a great way to do that is by having somebody like him hold the belt, and then you can use his reign to build up some of these guys, because you know what? Losing to Moxley might not be as damaging per se as it would be to losing to Naito. And then you can save those matches with Naito when he probably wins the belt back at Forbidden Door. So I think like adding somebody like Penta, who I believe it would be fresh matches across the board for Penta, like that adds some extra juice for Western fans to really get invested in the G1. Because there's probably no Okada, no Will Ospreay. Those are two workhorses, man. Like, the G1 will suffer without both of those two in it. Yeah. And I think it could be really cool to see a guy like him who could deliver a 4-star match every night. I don't think he's going to peak at like a 4.75 or 5, but you get a 4-star match every night from Penta, that's a huge win for a tournament like the G1.
Yeah. And it's just nice to play nice with your, you know, your allies, right?
Yeah. So
that should be pretty easy. I'm going to go through the AEW roster right now, and I'm just going to float some names of guys that like aren't particularly invested in anything right now that you could easily send over to New Japan. And I feel like would more than do their own, you know, would carry their role in the G1 or the Best of Super Junior, which obviously just concluded. Work with me here. This is a hypothetical. But I mean, I think they've got a lot of guys that they could do this with. But I'm just going to go through Brody King. They could easily send over to the G1, and that would be pretty awesome. Brian Keith is arguably a little under, you know, not well known yet, not established, but he's also doing the learning tree thing. I think Buddy Matthews, you could do basically the same thing with Brody King. Going on down this roster list, you know, Daniel Garcia is obviously getting ready for something big, but he would have been an option like a week ago. Darius or Dante Martin for the junior tournament would have been perfect. It's not like they've been, you know, keys to a storyline. Let's see. Jack Perry is obviously a big deal right now. And I'm not going to say like guys like Josh Woods, who I think would do well in a G1 situation, or if they want to qualify him as a best of the super junior. I think he's probably a little too big for that. But, you know, he's obviously not like a big name. So, you know, I wouldn't count him. And they wouldn't do Commander because he's, you know, AAA affiliated directly. So that's a problem. But you could have, you could send over, obviously, Lance Archer at any time. Even though that's kind of cheating, I feel like Kyle Riley would be a interesting guy to send back over there. You know,
would they consider him a heavy after having him slotted as a junior for so long?
You could always say that he's bulked up enough. You know, that's all storyline stuff. So that would be fine. You know, Matt Taven or Mike Bennett, I feel like is a little. You know, it's that's, you know, maybe Nick Wayne would be a great guy to have sent over. I know he's been in the running crew for Christian and all that, but if you could have worked out the timing on that, that would have been fine. I mean, it would have been a great opportunity for him, and I think he's good enough to justify it. I mean, I think sending over Pac would be a dream, but I think he's probably too loyal to Dragon Gate to do that. Ray Phoenix, obviously, would be fantastic. I think Ricky Starks would be really interesting.
You know what? Tony Khan did an interview and they asked about Ricky Starks, and he said he like kind of alluded to something with Starks, but didn't really say anything of substance. I wonder if he's a guy they may send over.
It'd be interesting. I don't know if Starks would be interested in that. I mean, we know that Ricky Starks is not interested in ladder matches. I'm sorry. Every time I think of Ricky Starks now, I think of, you know, I think of the ladder match where he was like, I'm not doing this shit.
Look, thank you. He's an all-time worker.
Work smarter, not harder. I just love it. It's fantastic. But you know, there's some options, you know, obviously right now they're doing something with Trent, so they wouldn't send him over, but he would have been a good guy before that. I mean, Sammy Guevara, you know, as a thing to do coming off his suspension. Might not be big enough for the G1, but the Super Junior would have been an option. So yeah, I mean, I'm not arguing for like Preston Vance to be given a spot in the G1 or anything like that. But you know, I would also say he's probably better than some of those NWA guys that got spots in the mid to late teens.
Hey, you know what? Send Preston Vance to the Champion Carnival. I think he could fit right in with the style in All Japan.
Or Noah, the N1.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to have a, all right, Preston, it's time for you to get, you know, better. Time to go trade some stiff elbows with 45-year-old grumpy guys.
Boom. I love that.
But that's the news. Let's talk about, just real quick notes. I didn't watch the entirety of the last collision, but I got to say that Ospreay and Kyle Riley off of that show was really great. I loved it.
Yay. A lot.
I think I gave it 4.5 stars. Yes, there it is. I thought that was a damn good match. And also, I really enjoyed the opener off the show, which was Leo Rush and Roderick Strong in a qualifier for that ladder match they're doing at Forbidden Door. Leo Rush and Roderick Strong are perfect dance partners because Leo is small enough where he can easily be herked around for Roderick Strong's various, you know, power moves, like, you know, the backbreakers, but also is fast and conditioned enough where he can keep up when Roddy's doing his you know, bursts of offense as well. And Leo is also a great, you know, underdog kind of comeback guy. So I thought they had a very good match. I think I went like 3.75 on it, but I'd love to see these guys have more matches in the future. Like, they're just, I feel like they're just tailor-made to work together.
Oh yeah, it's perfect because he's explosive enough to really sell and make that backbreaker style offense look good because he's small. Mm-hmm. But like, more of that pairing. Like, sometimes things just work, man. If Leo Rush stays fully committed, doesn't get hurt, and doesn't bail, like, just give me a 3-year run. I'm not asking for a lot, cool. God. Give me 3 years of Leo Rush, and I think you can have really fun.
He's a really talented guy. I know that there's a lot of... can you believe that outside of two NXT house shows that this is just the second Roderick Strong Leo Rush singles match? The first one was in 2016 at a co-promoted Ring of Honor New Japan War of the Worlds show in Dearborn, Michigan.
Oh, that's insane.
I may have to look that up. Yeah, that's a bummer. It's kind of a bummer that those two haven't worked more together. I really appreciated what they were doing together. And thought it was pretty cool. But anyways, there was a match on the Rampage listing that caught my eye, and I did not get to watch it before we did the show. Give me 1 second. Oh, yeah, it's Pac and Rocky Romero. I needed to watch that.
Ooh.
That just sounds cool as hell on paper. Yes. But, okay, Dynamite. I know we've been going an hour recently. We're over that. I don't know how long you want to go on this, but I thought this was kind of a middle-of-the-road Dynamite. I get like a 6 out of 10. Some solid matches on it, but nothing that I thought was truly great.
It's the kind of Dynamite where if you just read the results, you'll be okay.
Yeah, you can cheat on this one.
I'm not going to say don't go watch it, because I had fun. I enjoyed myself. I thought the four-way was really good, and I thought the win for Phoenix was great because Lethal had it like locked down, and then he got caught.
Yeah.
I like finishes like that. Like, I got to say, look, Lethal, if Lethal had like just that little bit extra, he could still be like a world champion kind of guy, because he is so solid in the ring. His moveset rocks. Like, if you did a create a wrestler moveset on a video game, Jay Lethal's would be like at the top of the list. He's got some sick offense. Lethal Injection rules. I still can't believe at 40 years old he's still doing that. That's bonkers. But and then you've got the figure four, you've got like Lethal Injection. There's just so much to his offense that rules. Like the back breaker flatliner is awesome.
Like the macho elbow. I mean,
yeah. Like
just always cool.
His offense rocks. He's just Jay Lethal. Like,
yeah. I thought the best thing on the show was the main event, Roddy and Swerve. I thought it was like a 3 3/4 level match, like definitely not anything I'll have a strong memory of at the end of the year, but a very, very good match. No, I wouldn't call it great, just a step short of that, but worth watching, especially if you have time. And the other best thing on it was Bryan Danielson's promo about the Owen tournament. It's very funny to, you know, obviously guys develop skills over time, etc. But it's very funny that like 20 years ago the knock on Danielson was he couldn't talk, and now he's just cutting fantastic promos like regularly and has been for quite a while. Outside of that, I thought the opening MJF promo was pretty good. Not his best stuff, but solid. A nice return promo, maybe a little long, but that's also the MJF experience, I think, maybe.
Are you Roosh excited for the feud with Roosh? Because I am thrilled about it.
I am looking forward to these two stiffing each other. Because Roosh, I can't imagine Roosh not being snug.
You know, locker room leader Roosh.
Yes, the perfect backstage citizen. But I think it could be a great match. Like, really, like, I think that there's a chance this could sneak into like 4.5-star, maybe even if given right and structured perfectly, 4 3/4.
This has potential to be a vanity pick for match of the year come January.
I could see somebody dropping that at 10, you know, like a real sicko, like AEW hardcore. I think Roosh is a fantastic worker. I love watching him wrestle, and MJF is, look, the problem last year wasn't work rate, you know, or however you want to classify ability in the ring. It was the other side of things, the storyline, the writing, whatever terminology you like there. So I think, you know, he's obviously, it's funny because early AEW, it was talk like, oh, MJF can't wrestle, he can only talk. And now, you know, it's kind of like people have turned around the other way. It was an ideas issue, not a performance issue. Obviously, ideas are a big part of the package. Hopefully, he'll have better ones now. He's definitely positioning himself in a way where he does have better ideas. But anyways, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, and it should be really fun. Now, what I thought was the worst thing on the show was the learning tree segments. I thought that there were too many of them, even though they're all pretty short. And it's a fine line when you're doing the fake smiley baby face guy to not be annoying.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's a meta commentary on aspects of wrestling that people do. And just like JAS was, you know, kind of a shot at sports entertainment style stuff. And this is kind of a different way to approach that. I just feel like it's not a success this week. I feel like a lot of the segments weren't really funny or entertaining. And so, you know, we kind of had this conversation, you and I also had a separate one with Mr. Warren Hayes, friend of the show, where you have this situation where you're doing kind of a meta commentary on wrestling. And Toni Storm, I think a lot of her gimmick for a while was this. You know, air quotes, telling stories in the ring, but it also is kind of undermined if, you know, what you're doing is not necessarily very entertaining. And I feel like that was at times a problem with the Toni Storm character, in that, you know, she's trying to do some interesting stuff, but I just think a lot of it didn't work as its own thing. And I feel like wrestling is maybe not the best medium for, you know, parody succeeding typically. So that's just kind of how I feel about the learning tree this week. And the rest of it was just solid, you know.
I have no idea if I like or dislike this learning tree gimmick, but I can say this with all certainty. It's one of the most over things when it comes to the quarter hour television ratings. People want to watch this. It's peaking very high on the segment by segment ratings. I have no idea what the end goal here is, but I like that they're using it for a way to get Big Bill and Brian Keith on television.
Yeah, I don't know if Brian Keith is fitting in with it right now. We'll see. I feel like it's way too early to write him off, obviously.
It feels like he's the muscle when Big Bill is right there. That I mean, I get it with the Bounty Hunter gimmick, but mm-hmm. it just feels odd. I don't know what to think of this whole thing, but Jericho's so good at getting anything over that I want to see it play out. Even if I don't necessarily like it, I want to see it play out because the end goal could be really good. I just have no idea. I just have faith in Jericho to make something good on television.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, he has obviously the track record, and I think he's one of the guys that'll, you know, be able to figure out how to make something like this work. It's just, it's not there right now. So,
yeah.
And that's kind of, I mean, that's generally my thoughts on the show. I thought that like the BCC CMLL match was fun, but not essential. Another thing that I was negative on was the Acclaimed. Like, I just really do think I need the Acclaimed to go away for a few months, you know, and to have them, I'm not really excited to see them feud with Young Bucks. And I don't know how I feel about this Young Bucks gimmick right now, honestly, either. That's another one that's kind of on a fine line. Willow had a good promo, and Daniel Garcia had a nice pre-tape. Those were kind of my big overarching thoughts on the show. You got anything else?
I love Willow. Push her to the moon, and then push her back to the moon. God, she is the best thing in this company right now for me. Like, her growth, development, taking advantage of every opportunity, and she's gotten so much better on the mic. Like, and you know what, for a baby face, she knows how to lay it in, man. Like some of those doctor bombs are just gnarly, and I love it. I
she's
love
a great Willow Knight. Worker, good talker, great talker, really great personality.
Yeah,
it pops off the screen. I think she is. They gotta push her right. That's all they gotta do. The obvious comparison is Bayley, just because of the happy bubbly baby face thing. This is how WWE should have booked Bayley, you know, and did not, and kind of kneecapped her. So I hope that, and I have faith that they won't, but I hope AEW is able to avoid the same problems. They're doing a great job so far.
Yeah. I'm really intrigued to kind of see how this ends up working out and push her to the moon. I'd have her win the Owen. I'd have her win the title, but I think that they're gonna do something with Mariah May, and I wonder if maybe Mariah May costs Tony the title at Wembley, and that's kind of how they start the feud. I'm just very intrigued with the women's division right now, and Britt Baker and Jamie Hayter are still MIA. Wait till they come back, then you're gonna have a very strong women's division, and it's being booked well right now. Like, you have not just feuds for the title, you have some undercard stuff. And I think that's great. I want to continue to see how this grows and develops. And this could be really good. We'll find out. I think that's the show. Like, subscribe, do all the fun things. Give us a 5-star review on whatever podcast app you are listening to. We would be very appreciative. And we will be back next week to talk more All Elite Wrestling. I'm Tyler. He's Fred. Have a great one.
Y'all take care.
Cheering at pro wrestling shows in Japan is back, and 2023 is already shaping up to be a big year in the history of pro res. That's why you should listen to the Emerald Flow Show. From the Royal Road to the Green Mat, Paul and Gerard take you into the world of All Japan Pro Wrestling and Pro Wrestling NOAH. Not only do we analyze events, but we examine business, who is getting over, what angles are working or not. Occasionally, we take a look at other Japanese promotions like DDT and Zero One. So if you're looking for more coverage of the world of Japanese wrestling, check out the Emerald Flow Show on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on all of your favorite podcast apps.